This is a $100 trillion banknote from Zimbabwe, one of the most worthless currencies ever. The paper it's printed on is worth more than the money itself. Hyperinflation has come down hard on the country. At its peak in 2008, prices doubled every 24 hours. People went to sleep thinking they were middle class, only to find out the next day that they were now poor. Food prices rose so quickly that Zimbabwe, once a regional breadbasket, had to import food from abroad just to feed its population. At the same time, the national debt piled up, and obligations to international creditors restrained how it could spend its budget. Not long after, economic decline set in, productivity dropped, and events like droughts and natural disasters made the situation even worse. Today, Zimbabwe has one of the worst economies in the world. About one out of every three people lives in extreme poverty. But now, the government is looking to make things right. It's addressing the point where it all went downhill, when it confiscated land from its white farmers and forced them to leave. That decision triggered the country's economic collapse, and since 2017, the government has been negotiating for the return of its white Zimbabwean community. However, reconciliation has not been easy, and resentment runs high. White farmers are skeptical about the government's sincerity, while indigenous Zimbabwean farmers fear losing their newly acquired properties. Something has to give. While history holds grudges, hunger doesn't. No matter the industry, keeping track of revenues and expenses is essential. Odoo, the sponsor of this video, helps me to do just that. Odoo is an all-in-one management software that provides a range of applications, including invoicing, accounting, project management, website creation, and more. In my experience, Odoo has simplified tedious day-to-day tasks, allowing me to focus on what truly matters. Normally, you would need a dozen other apps to do what Odoo does on its own, and the first app is totally free for life, with unlimited hosting and support. Its invoicing app is incredibly efficient. Here's how it works. First, I identify the customer I work with. Then I add the services I want to invoice. Next, I indicate the quantities and set the billing terms, such as date, project reference, and so on. Finally, I send out the invoice by email. I also get the ability to keep track of previous discussions with the client, such as emails and notes. The whole process is a breeze to set up. Check out Odoo today by hitting the link in the description and supporting me by supporting them. Thanks, Odoo. Unlike most African countries that became independent in the 1960s, Zimbabwe was off to a late start. It only became its own country in 1980, and even then, it was almost replaced by a different state called Rhodesia. You see, years earlier in 1965, the white minority administration of Rhodesia unilaterally declared independence from Britain. It fell on deaf ears, though. No one recognized it. In fact, the United Nations went out of its way to shut down Rhodesia. The Security Council banned arms sales to the country in 1966 and then restricted all imports and exports. However, when the sanctions failed to change Rhodesia's behavior, it became clear that the state couldn't be dismantled like the other colonies had been. That's when a young activist named Mugabe threw his support behind a group called the Zimbabwe African National Union, or ZANU for short. Their mission was a straight-up revolution, to fight for majority rule and remove the white minority government. What came next was Africa's version of the Cold War. Angola, Zambia, and Tanzania supported Mugabe's ZANU by supplying weapons and funding. Meanwhile, South Africa became the biggest backer of Rhodesian forces. With weapons pouring in from all sides, Rhodesia fell into a violent civil war from 1964 onwards. After 15 years and 30,000 casualties, a ceasefire was established in 1979, promising elections the following year. ZANU's political party won those elections, and Mugabe became the prime minister. After taking office, Mugabe dismantled Rhodesia and its civil service, and then renamed the country Zimbabwe. The international community approved of the power transition, and Zimbabwe was recognized globally. However, besides a PR facelift, Zimbabwe still faced tremendous problems. During colonial times, land ownership had been unequally divided. For example, around 4,400 white farmers owned 51% of the arable land, while 4.3 million indigenous Zimbabweans owned only 42%. So, yeah, highly unequal. On top of that, indigenous Zimbabweans weren't allowed to own certain types of commercial land. So, when Mugabe took power, land reform was a top priority. At first, his government tried to buy land from white farmers voluntarily. It worked, but the process was slow. Between 1980 and 1987, white-owned land shrank by 20%, which Mugabe felt wasn't enough. The wealth gap was still massive. Even though white farmers made up roughly 2% of the population, they controlled a big chunk of the economy, with some estimates putting it as high as 40% of the GDP. To address this, Mugabe spearheaded a land reform that took privately owned farmland and put it under government control. Starting in the year 2000, the land reform forced white commercial farmers to give up their properties to indigenous Zimbabweans. This, however, turned into a complete disaster. While the intent was to address colonial-era wrongdoings and economic inequality, the program was riddled with violence, corruption, and mismanagement. Most of the confiscated farmland was handed out to Mugabe's political allies, who didn't know the first thing about commercial farming. And so, what came next was economic contraction. The sudden removal of experienced farmers caused agriculture to fall apart. Zimbabwe, once the region's breadbasket, saw its agricultural productivity nosedive. By 2006, food shortages were everywhere, and about a third of the people needed some level of food aid to survive. In just a few years, Zimbabwe went from exporting food to importing it. But it got worse from there. Western nations placed sanctions on Zimbabwe for its displacement of white farmers, which isolated the country economically. In his attempt to fix the situation, Mugabe made one bad decision after another. Instead of allowing foreign aid to help people in need, especially in the countryside, he closed off the country, claiming that the NGOs were supporting his political opponents. Next, Mugabe had the idea to print massive amounts of money to cover government debts, which had piled up following the land reform. His advisors warned him not to, but he did it anyway. As expected, inflation skyrocketed. It went from double digits to triple, quadruple, quintuple, and beyond. By 2008, hyperinflation hit a staggering 79.6 billion percent. Yeah, that's billion with a B. It's hard to truly comprehend these numbers. Mugabe must have thought so as well. His government, along with Zimbabwe's Reserve Bank, pointed the finger at Western sanctions. Some people never observe anything. Life just happens to them. In April 2009, a year into hyperinflation, Zimbabwe ditched its national currency and switched to a multi-currency system, mainly using the US dollar and South African rand. It took nearly a decade to stabilize the economy, but by then, the Zimbabwean dollar wasn't the only thing that was replaced. In November 2017, a military coup removed Mugabe from power and Vice President Mnangagwa took his place. Mnangagwa took a more reasonable approach to the West and admitted that bringing back white farmers was key to rebuilding Zimbabwe's economy. Doing so would boost the economy in many ways. It would increase agricultural production, improve food security, create jobs, and grow exports. Plus, it would bring in much-needed foreign currency and roll back the sanctions. The problem, however, was that all the confiscated farmlands had been given to political allies during the Mugabe era. Mnangagwa couldn't just upend the current owners without risking his own office. So instead, he set up joint ventures that encouraged some white farmers to return. The program aimed to combine expertise and resources to revive the agricultural sector. It worked well enough. Today, there are about 900 white Zimbabwean commercial farms, and agricultural productivity has picked up. However, the majority of white farmers refuse to return because they don't trust the government. They argue that the circumstances and terms need to change before they can consider coming back. One problem with the current setup is that commercial farms operate under lease agreements with indigenous Zimbabweans who got the farmlands during Mugabe's rule. So there has been no transfer or return of territory, and the white farmers who have come back are not working on their original lands. What's more, indigenous Zimbabweans who benefited from Mugabe's reforms fear losing their newly acquired properties. And their concerns have to be taken into account as well, since they have deep running ties to the political elite. This then places Mnangagwa in a tough spot. He needs white farmers to come back, but at the same time, he needs to reassure indigenous Zimbabweans that they won't lose out. Any misstep here could easily reignite racial tensions and undermine nationwide stability. And that's where everything has stalled until recently. In October 2024, Zimbabwe's leadership negotiated to financially compensate the remaining white farmers and encourage them to return. It approved 441 compensation claims totaling over $3.5 billion and an additional 94 claims from foreign farmers worth more than $196 million. For reference, these foreign claimants include individuals from Europe. However, according to the terms of the deal, only 1% of the total amount will be paid in cash. The rest will be reimbursed through treasury bonds. This is a major sticking point. Zimbabwe has no economy to speak of, and so treasury bonds issued by the state are as worthless as its old banknotes. Plus, the compensation doesn't cover the loss of land, only the loss of infrastructure like buildings, machinery, and irrigation systems. Moreover, and perhaps most importantly, around the same time the government announced the compensation plan for white farmers, it also passed a bill giving indigenous Zimbabweans full ownership of their leased land. The same bill also permits the exchange of farmland to other indigenous Zimbabweans, but not white Zimbabweans. Ethics aside, this haggle was meant to reassure indigenous Zimbabweans that they wouldn't lose out as white farmers returned. However, in practice, leasing land is not economically sustainable for white farmers. In landlocked, sanctioned, and cash-strapped Zimbabwe, accessing capital is next to impossible. To get a loan from the bank, farmers need to put up land as collateral. A lease, however, doesn't count since it can be legally taken away at any time. Hence, white farmers who can't legally own the land they farm can't get loans and make investments needed to grow their businesses. And that single fact renders everything else irrelevant. So, in spite of the progressive rhetoric, the whole program to reinstate white farmers isn't working. In fact, it may be intentionally designed to fail. Consider Zimbabwe's place in global politics for a moment. The state is deeply in debt and under Western sanctions. Mnangagwa's government is engaged in two separate but intertwined negotiations that look to change that. It's in talks with the African Development Bank to restructure its $21 billion debt, and it's in talks with the United Nations to lift Western sanctions. In both negotiations, the white farmers' compensation is a key issue. Mnangagwa's government is likely stalling these two negotiations by making lots of promises vis-à-vis white farmers, but without actually resolving the issue. Here's the thing, by appearing to negotiate in good faith, by offering compensation and asking white farmers to come back, even if under impractical conditions, Zimbabwe makes it look like it wants to make amends. And most of the time, in diplomatic negotiations, that nuance works. Mnangagwa's approach could be enough to convince international powers to lift sanctions and rearrange debt, all while avoiding blowback from indigenous Zimbabwean farmers. Sure, the country won't live up to its full potential, its agricultural productivity will stall, and many endemic problems will persist. But with sanctions lifted and unpaid debts sorted out, the state could apply to the IMF for loans and take it from there, even if that comes at the cost of GDP growth. This is, of course, a hypothetical of Zimbabwe's strategy. There's no way of knowing if it's true, but similar negotiating strategies have been used in other places. Diplomacy, after all, is the art of telling people to go to hell in such a way that they look forward to the trip. I've been your host Shirvan from Caspian Report. If you approve of what we do, please leave a comment, hit the like button, and mayhaps share the video. In any case, thank you for your time, and salam.